Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Christina Clack and I will be your presider this morning. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member or a member of the wider community, and we have one of our own. We have one of our own members, Matt, who I'll introduce in a few minutes, presenting today, so I look very forward to that. Our opening words this morning will be provided by Evan.
We have found the definition of person, namely, the individual substance of a rational nature.
Our chalice lighting this morning will be provided by Heidi, James, and Rachel.
May this flame, symbol of transformation since time began, fire our curiosity, strengthen our wills, and sustain our courage as we seek what is good within and around us.
I am very pleased this morning to introduce our speaker. Matt Tedesco received his BA in Philosophy and English from Hofstra University and his MA and PhD in Philosophy from the University of Colorado at Boulder. His research interests are primarily in ethical theory and applied ethics. Since 2004, he has been a professor of philosophy at Beloit College, where he teaches a range of courses including ethical theory, biomedical ethics, environmental ethics, philosophy of law, and logic. And he just shared with me before this program that he taught a 6-week course on animal rights, so that's really exciting to me. He now serves as Associate Dean of Beloit College. He and his family have been coming to Prairie UU since this past summer, and hopefully everything's all set up, and please help me welcome Matt.
I guess I'll just start with a couple of brief kind of preliminary comments. First, I want to thank Penny and frankly all of you for having me give this talk today. You know, when Penny approached me a couple of months ago and said, well, you know, is there anything that connected with your teaching that you think might make for an interesting talk? Among other things at Beloit, so I teach biomedical ethics, and we always talk a bit about personhood. And I thought, well, you know, the first principle here concerns the inherent dignity and worth of persons, and so that might make for an interesting conversation for a little while. I guess I also want to start with two sort of brief apologies. The first apology is I've been under the weather for the last few days, and so I don't feel 100% shipshape, but I guess I particularly apologize to Kim. So this Kim, today is her birthday. And I'm generally a pretty healthy person, yet I always seem to get sick on her birthday. And I feel bad about that. And the other is, I guess I want to say, it's always a bit of a challenge to figure out how to pitch a talk like this, right? I mean, I have a general sense of the audience, but not a deep one. And so what I don't know is how broad a background some of you might have in philosophy. And so this talk is really aimed at an audience where there's not a tremendous background in philosophy. So I guess the apology is if there are some of you who have a significant background in philosophy, some of this might seem like old news. So if that's the case, I apologize too. That said, and let's see if this works. Let me sort of dive right in. All right, excellent. All right. So the first thing I guess I thought it would be useful to do is just to say a little bit about what philosophy is. And I guess I make sure it says, yeah, well, I'm on the right one. Yeah, good. You know, philosophy is sort of an interesting discipline, I think. In fact, I don't really think it's a discipline, but that's for another conversation. It's different than other disciplines in that it doesn't wear its subject matter on its sleeve, right? So for example, if you're studying biology, I mean, you know, what does it mean? Well, the study of life, right? It's kind of straightforward, right? If you're studying art. But philosophy, you know, so what's that? And etymologically, you sort of break it down, right? It's a love of wisdom, but that really doesn't help a heck of a lot. And so just a little bit about philosophy. I think what I have here on the slide is a distinction that I think is an important one to keep in mind. On the one hand, you could talk about the subject matter of philosophy, and that ranges over well, a lot of ground. And so philosophers deal with questions in metaphysics. So, you know, Penny before was mentioning, you know, the existence of God, or the nature of persons, or the possibility of free will, right? These are all metaphysical questions. And philosophers think about epistemological problems concerning knowledge. Right? So what does it mean to know something? Is knowledge possible? How should we reckon with the specter of skepticism? Philosophers deal with problems in ethics, which is really what I'm most directly, I think, taking on today, or at least mean to be sort of introducing and talking about a little bit today. Philosophers deal with problems in politics. Philosophers deal with the study of reasoning itself in logic. It's a broad discipline. And then the other thing I guess I want to say, philosophy, in particular Western philosophy, is, you know, associated with a lot of dead white guys. I sort of say that, look, philosophy honors its history, and it's an old discipline stretching back to ancient Greece. And so there's a lot to build on there, and we'll do a quick tour of some dead white guys as this kind of stumbles along today. But we're not going to spend a heck of a lot of time with dead white guys because I want to get to some living people at some point and what they have to say about personhood too. And so we'll get there. Maybe more importantly, for thinking about what philosophy is and what its contribution is to how we think about and understand the world, I think more important than the subject matter of philosophy is its method. What do philosophers do? And what I say here in the slide is, I think that the right way to think about philosophers, whether they're engaging in questions in metaphysics or aesthetics or ethics or whatever, is what they're doing is engaging in the evaluation of arguments and the analysis of concepts to try to get a clear understanding of, well, whatever it is we're talking about. And so I thought it was really interesting, you know, Penny in her little story for all ages mentioned a different UU principle, and as I was sort of pulling them up and I saw that one on the free and responsible search for truth and meaning, I thought, well, there's a sense in which, you know, that principle sort of embodies, I think, what philosophy always intends to be about, stretching all the way back to Socrates. That's a little bit about philosophy and what it is as a discipline. But did we die?
No.
Okay, we're back. All right, good. So the first principle, let's sort of dive into this. And we've already found it on the wall. There it is. You can look right. The inherent worth and dignity of every person. And I guess what I want to say right at the top of this talk is I don't mean to be at least directly challenging anything about that principle. And I don't really mean, I'm in fact quite supportive of it. But I do mean to be exploring it a little bit. And so I'm not quite sure if I'm really staking anything out in this talk so much as just raising some questions that I hope will spark some good conversation as we move along. I said it on the last slide that what philosophy fundamentally is about as a method is the evaluation of arguments and the analysis of concepts. And so, you know, packed into that first principle are some really interesting concepts, right? And so I highlighted just a few of them in red there, right? So you could talk about the notion of worth, right? I take it that that's a kind of moral claim, right? That when we're talking about something as having a kind of worth, what we mean is morally speaking, right? They're owed a kind of consideration by virtue of the sort of thing that they are. And I take it the notion of dignity is wrapped up in that too. And so that, you know, all by themselves, those are some interesting terms that, you know, we could explore in some detail. And maybe we will as this kind of skims along today. Although I take it the concept that I take is the central one for us to talk about today is the concept of person. What do we mean when we call something a person? What is it to be a person? And why is that an interesting concept to explore? So let me make a distinction right off the top here that I guess for me has been a helpful one in thinking through our language around some important terms. And it's a distinction between the category of human and the category of person. Now, on the face of it, that might not seem like an interesting distinction, because I think as we generally understand those two categories, they're coextensive, right? They map onto each other. That is, I look around this room right now and I see a whole mass of humans, and I happen to also see a whole mass of persons. And so there's not an important distinction, at least on the face of it, you might think, between these two terms. But I think when you push a little bit, I think it's useful to separate them, at least as potentially marking off two different kinds of categories. The first category is a purely biological or genetic or sort of physical category, right? So to be a member of that category, the category of humans, is to be essentially, is to have a certain kind of genetic configuration, right? It's to be a member of a certain kind of species. Whereas, I take it the term person is a moral term. It's a term that picks out a moral category. Right? It signifies something as having, and this is a kind of sloppy way of thinking about it, but I like this, and I'll use this term probably more times than this in this talk, as having a certain kind of moral specialness. Right? That is, for something to be a person is to be owed a certain kind of moral consideration. Right? You know, a mosquito buzzing about annoying you, you swat it and kill it, you don't think anything sort of it. You know, if I'm annoying you and you swat me and kill me, right, it's sort of a different thing entirely, right? And I take it at least it's partly because, at least ordinarily, we think of mosquitoes as non-persons, as me as a person. I'm owed a certain kind of consideration that a mosquito isn't. Now, maybe to think about this more, and this is sort of a corny slide, but I'll put it up here. Just to give you a way to think about this, right? Here's a selection of some non-human persons. They're all sort of science fiction-y in their own ways, right? So I take it at least one person on here ought to be familiar to everybody. I'm not sure which that is, but you know, good. So we've got Spock, right? From Star Trek. I think I put Chewbacca on there. There's E.T. If you remember the 80s TV show Alf, maybe nobody does but me, but there he is, Gordon Shumway. All right, we've got, interestingly on there, one more Star Trek character. Maybe you don't know him. He's sort of an android, Lieutenant Commander Data. Now look, you know, I don't mean to sort of embroil us in science fiction here, though I think philosophers love science fiction, generally speaking. And I think it's because what science fiction can do sometimes is present the kinds of thought experiments that philosophers have been famous for thousands of years, right? What's a thought experiment? Well, right, I take it we can imagine cases, even if they don't sort of map onto our own experiences of the world, and ask, well, what about those cases? What should we say about that? right? Now, I take it, I'll just use the case of Spock for example, because I take it probably most of you have at least heard of Star Trek or are familiar with this notion. Now, Spock's an interesting character because he's actually genetically half human and half Vulcan, right? And so I take it that's a meaningful thing to say, right? That Spock's sort of half human. But I take it that there's a sense, a pretty clear sense, in which he's a whole person, right? It's not as if he sort of merits, you know, half a moral status just by virtue of being half human, right? That is, if Spock walked in here now, right, and said, you know, live long and prosper or whatever, right, we wouldn't say, well, you know, he counts half as much as anybody else in here, right? Similarly, if E.T. walked in and sort of toddled around and fixed the plants and stuff, right, and I sort of, you know, walked up to him and swatted him like a mosquito and killed him, presumably I've done something wrong, right? You know, there's E.T. out with his friends. I never knew this, by the way. I read this on IMDb a little while ago. E.T. was a botanist. Did you know that? I didn't know that. I thought he was a kid. Anyway, he was like an intergalactic botanist collecting. Anyway, all right. So at any rate, if he comes in, E.T. says, I've been traveling the galaxy with me and my friends. We're collecting plants. We crashed. I want to get home. And I killed him. I've done something wrong, right? Something seriously wrong, even though he's not a human. Okay, so this is just meant to get on the table that, you know, I think the category of person is a really interesting category. Right, because it's a morally important category. We use it to pick out a morally special group of beings. And while in our experience, I think very ordinarily, we think of humans and persons as coextensive, recognize, right, those categories can come apart. And so that opens up the following set of really interesting questions. Right? Are there non-humans who are persons? Are there humans who are non-persons? Right? At least conceptually. Right? At least conceptually, the fact that these two categories come apart, right, suggests that those are both at least live conceptual possibilities. All right, so now just a quick tour of some dead white guys. I won't belabor the history of philosophy here. But I guess what I want to just briefly suggest is that the notion of our faculty of reason as being tied in some deep way to what it is that makes us the sort of special beings we are, I think is deeply embedded in the history of philosophy. I didn't even put Aristotle on this slide. You know, Aristotle's definition of man was as the rational animal. And so I did put Boethius on here, and he was the opening comment that we read today was just the one that I put up here. I guess he's often cited as the first philosopher to attempt to define the term person, and so I thought it'd be interesting to sort of put that up there. And so if you sort of extract the biological categorization from Aristotle's definition, right, man as the rational animal, right, well, what's a person, right? Well, it's the individual substance of a rational nature, right, so the rational substance. And that focus on reason and our rational faculties is ubiquitous in the history of Western philosophy. And so I put up on the slide also René Descartes. Just an enormously important figure in the intellectual history of Western civilization, both as a mathematician and as a philosopher. His meditations on first philosophy are often taken to be really the start of modern philosophy. So they're written in 1641. I put Descartes on here because he's sort of famous for fundamentally identifying what he is, right? And by extension, what we are as thinking things. And there'd be a lot to say about this, that this comes in the second meditation, and he's really exploring a lot of interesting questions through the meditations. But again, the emphasis is on, and then he gives this sort of long list after the quote that I put up here, right? What am I, right? A thing that thinks, that doubts, that affirms, that reasons, that questions, right? This is fundamentally what I am, right? Yeah, you know, you could talk about the biological facts about me, but that's not the essence of me, right? It's this rational thinking essence. And then I also put Immanuel Kant up on the slide. And I mention this because Kant's ethics are still widely referred to across a range of, you know, you wouldn't get through sort of a business ethics class without sort of encountering him. I remember talking to Kim's doctor years ago when we were having a baby, and he's like, oh, you do ethics. Right, Kant, right? So respect for persons, right? So he's sort of a famous figure in the history of ethics, and you come upon him even if perhaps you don't take philosophy, but you study ethics somewhere. At any rate, you know, Kant is famous for, well, there's the quote, right, for identifying rational nature as what he calls an end in itself, right? The idea that by virtue of being a rational being, you ought to be treated fundamentally as an end in yourself, right? You're owed a certain kind of consideration, right? It's interesting that the word worth is built into that first principle, because Kant talks about the inherent worth of persons, right, by virtue of being rational beings. At any rate, that's just a kind of quick sketch of some historical philosophers to give you a sense that I think there's a really strong theme of connecting the notion of our kind of inherent natures, and in particular our moral specialness, with our rational faculties. All right, put aside dead white guys for a bit. And turn now to some more contemporary philosophers. I'm going to just present just two quick contemporary philosophers to you today, just to kind of explore this topic in a bit more detail. The first is a guy named Michael Tooley. Now, Michael Tooley offered a famous paper. Actually, both papers I'm going to quickly mention today are papers from the early 70s, and they're papers exploring the context of personhood in the particular context of abortion. Not surprisingly, if you think about the time period, right? This is right at the same time that Roe v. Wade was before the Supreme Court, and so there was quite a lot of interest in understanding the moral question of abortion, as related to, but potentially different from, the political or legal question of abortion. Tooley writes a famous paper called Abortion and Infanticide, where he wants to explore what it means to be a person. And he very quickly, but I think, at least I find compelling, he rejects a range of possible criteria for personhood. Right, and I list them here, right? So there's birth, viability, spontaneous movement, attaining of human form and conception. The idea being, none of those seem to mark off what it means to be a person. The first two, actually the second one in particular, viability, is ultimately where the Supreme Court has landed and sort of remains landed. But even that's sort of an interesting one, because viability is just a kind of statement of your physiological independence. But I take it anyone who needs blood pressure medication or dialysis is not sort of physiologically independent, yet is still a person, right? At least this is sort of Tooley's argument. At any rate, here's what Tooley sort of lands on. Tooley thinks that fundamentally, personhood, what it means to be a person, is connected with self-consciousness. Where what he means by self-consciousness is something specific. Right? That is, look, personhood is connected with a range of moral rights, fundamentally among them the right to life. Well, what kinds of beings have a right to life? And for Tooley, right, the idea is you have a right to life if you have a certain kind of concept. You're capable of grasping the notion of something being kind of a continuing existing entity over time. And you see yourself as this kind of a thing. And so Tooley says, look, anything that has that kind of self-consciousness, right, is a person. And if you lack it, then you're not a person. You could sort of see this is a pretty high bar. And so I'll explore that in a slide or two. But I want to jump really quickly now to another paper by Marianne Warren. Her paper is called On the Moral and Legal Status of Abortion. It came out just a year after Tooley's. These are both papers in the early 70s. What Warren sort of approaches the question of personhood from a slightly different angle. She says, look, let's sort of figure out the range of characteristics that we identify persons as having. And she comes up with sort of five central characteristics that she elaborates and defends. Recognize I'm being very quick here. I mean, these are papers that all by themselves kind of deserve, you know, a couple of hours of discussion, and I'm giving them to you in about 30 seconds each. So I hope I'm not moving too quickly, and I hope maybe in conversation we can bring these out in more detail if you like. At any rate, there are her five central characteristics of personhood. Consciousness, meaning specifically, for her, it's about a certain level of sentience or ability to experience pain. Reasoning, which she identifies as connected with problem solving, at least in some basic or rudimentary way. Self-motivated activity, really meaning just movement that isn't purely instinctual. Communication across a range of topics in a variety of types, and then also the presence of self-concepts, right? Understanding the sort of thing that I am. Now here's her point. I think this is actually a really interesting analysis, because Warren says, look, it's not, look, here's where I think she's probably right. Right? When we think about persons and what it is that we identify in persons, probably a list like this seems about right. Now, Warren's point, though, is sort of complicated. She says, look, it's not obvious how many of these you need to be a person. But here's what is obvious. Anything that lacks all five of these is not a person. That's sort of her angle. So instead of trying to figure out what makes something a person with clarity, it's sort of trying to figure out what makes you not a person. It's basically lacking all of these. If you have some of them, though, now you get to be in that personhood conversation, right? And now we've got some hard work to do to figure out, well, how many of these you need and how much of them you need to be a person. That's kind of a quick tour of some historical and contemporary philosophers and what they've had to say about this. Now, sort of what does it mean for some contemporary cases? And I guess I'll say that there's a lot we could talk about, but I guess I wanted to put on the table at least three interesting cases, right? Three interesting sets of beings where I think it's at least not entirely unreasonable to ask, right? Are they persons? Are they persons? The third of those probably being the most controversial. So look, I'll start with the first. And actually, this was sort of a late addition. I initially had this talk sort of sketched in my mind, and then I thought this would be an interesting addition to it for a variety of reasons. There's actually been a lot, in particular very recently in the news, about the question of the extension of the category of personhood to chimps in particular. There was a rather famous case in Austria in 2007 brought to the courts there, attempting to have a chimpanzee declared as a person, and that failed. But much more recently, and I only discovered this because this is really just about a month old, this is early December of last year, an organization called the Non-Human Rights Project it was actually in New York, and they chose New York because they thought the New York courts might be sympathetic to this. But they brought three separate suits forward in attempting to have, essentially all of them were concerned chimpanzees, and they all were attempting to, declare that chimps ought to have a right of habeas corpus, right? So essentially to not be held, right, without a hearing, Right? The idea being they were essentially being held as prisoners against their will, and they ought to be given a fair hearing or a fair trial. Now, all three of these suits failed. One was dismissed, though. At least two were heard before a judge before they were dismissed, and the group holds it up as a victory, though I'm not quite sure if that's true. But at least very interestingly, you can sort of see where they're coming from here, right? Is a great ape a person? Well, they're not human genetically, that's obvious, right? Although, you know, if you want to get right down to it, they're pretty darn close, right? But, you know, look, what is it that makes something a person? I don't know. Go back to those lists that we saw. Do they have a capacity for reason? What about Thule's point about self-consciousness? What about Marianne Warren's central criteria? Well, if you look at those lists of central criteria, it seems like they check off at least some of them, right? So perhaps. Now, I'll jump to the most controversial case next, which is the case of newborns, and correspondingly, the question of the moral status of infanticide, of the killing of newborns. Now, I take it, ordinarily, we take that to be widely settled as a very serious crime. Thule's paper is famous in part because he is challenging this, right? Thule says, look, we need to be careful about separating actions that we find repugnant purely as a matter of taboo from actions that we find repugnant because they're actually grounded in a rational prohibition. And Thule says, look, when you get right down to it, right, there's no good reason to think that a child of, say, a week old has any of the criteria that we associate with personhood. And so we ought not to think of the killing of a newborn infant as the killing of a person.
Whoa.
Yeah, well, look, you can imagine some people have some very strong responses to Thule here. But, you know, Thule, you know, look, this paper is now 40 years old, but he hasn't wavered in his stance, and in fact, there are other philosophers who agree with him on this, right? That, look, there are lots of things that historically people have found deeply repugnant, right? That we look back on now and recognize, you know, maybe there's nothing wrong with that. Right? Everything from behaviors about how to dispose of the dead to homosexual practices to wherever, right? Practices that would routinely be met with great moral opposition, and now we recognize maybe ought not to be. So anyway, that's sort of Thule's line on this. Warren, sort of interesting, she wrote a postscript to her paper in 1982 addressing this question of infanticide, where she says, well, hold on a minute. You know, I don't want to be defending infanticide here. And so she works hard in this postscript to try to convince the reader that infanticide is morally wrong, but it's not the killing of a person, right? That's the view that she ultimately lands on, right? That there are good reasons to think infanticide is wrong. It's hard to sort of tease those out, but whatever they are, it's not about the killing of a person. Now, even that, I take it, we might not find very satisfying, right? I mean, we want to be able to say that a child, a newborn child of a week or two old, is a person. The catch, though, obviously, is saying that kind of raises the question of what we ought to say about the fetus, right? Now, you know, I take it, and this is something we could talk about more, but this is something I take it that's true of a lot of the philosophers who have written on this. It's very hard if you're just talking about the thing itself, right? The fetus versus the newborn, right? To try to make a distinction in what it is between something a month or two before birth and a month or two after birth. And so it's that sort of continuum that has, I think, been such an interesting and thorny problem for, well, not just philosophers, I think anyone sort of interested in the question of the moral status of abortion. Now, I mentioned on this slide, and in some ways this is coming to the end of the talk here. I'm making sure I'm in the right place. I am good. All right, so if you sort of think about the history of the politics of abortion, I mean, obviously, going all the way back to Roe v. Wade through Planned Parenthood versus Casey, there's a history in the courts of making a distinction with respect to viability. But in the last year, if you've been sort of watching this issue, there's actually been a kind of a new movement with respect to the moral status, or I should say the legal status of abortion, that has sort of taken hold, at least in 12 states currently. I expect more may follow, and I also expect this to become more of a story in the national stage in the next year or two. It was in... did I write down the date here? Yeah, June of last year, that the House of Representatives passed the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, which was largely by a party line vote, and it's an attempt to move back the line where abortion is permissible to about 20 weeks. The idea being, and this is an empirical question, and it's an open empirical question, the idea being at least, the claim being that that's the line, that's the place at which a fetus can feel pain, right? Now, this has been introduced in the Senate just a few months ago by Lindsey Graham, well, at any rate, there's a lot to say about the political question here, but I think what's interesting philosophically is the shift, right? Are we interested in whether or not the fetus is a person anymore? Well, maybe that's not the interesting moral question. Right? You might think the interesting moral question is a somewhat blunter question. Right? Can the fetus feel pain or not? Maybe that's more interesting than this question of personhood and our rational natures. Maybe in some ways I'm stealing the thunder from the opening, closing words, because I wanted to put them on this slide too. Jeremy Bentham is widely seen as the founder of utilitarianism, which is a moral theory, I won't talk about it here, that's had a lot of influence both in and beyond philosophy, especially in economics, in the last couple of hundred years. But he's famous for asking the question, well, does it matter if something is rational? More fundamentally, isn't what matters whether or not they can suffer, whether or not they can experience pain and pleasure, right? Maybe, and so his point, right, because he's directly addressing non-human animals here, right, is that, well, look, it really doesn't matter whether or not an animal is a person. It really doesn't matter whether or not it's rational. What matters is whether or not it can experience pain or not. And that takes me to my last slide, sort of back to the opening, back to the first principle. Think about the inherent worth and dignity of every person. We sort of explored in the last, I don't know, half hour or so, what's a person? you know, us, by that I mean humans. If so, when do we become persons? Also interesting, when do we stop being persons? That's an interesting question too. Non-human animals, if so, which ones? But the last question I want to leave you with is, how important is that category? Right? At least there's some reason to think that when you're talking about the kinds of things that matter morally, that maybe have some inherent worth and dignity, that need not be confined to the category of persons. Mm-hmm. Right? That maybe Bentham was onto something in thinking that whether or not something is a person or rational is different from whether or not it can experience the world and suffer pain and experience pleasure. And maybe that's what gets you sort of a kind of inherent worth or dignity. At any rate, I'll stop there because I want to make sure we have some time to discuss this. Yeah. Yeah, great. So about all that was a great range of comments. should I respond? So on the first one, about brain activity, I think that's a potentially interesting marker, but I think you need to be careful what kind of brain activity. So the kind of brain activity that we associate with autonomic functioning happens relatively early in fetal development. On the flip side, if you think about, for example, how we measure clinical brain death at the end of life, that's the termination of a higher kind of brain functioning. And we know by electroencephalogram readings that that happens later in fetal development, right? Somewhere between, I think, something like 23 and 28 weeks. Whereas brain activity simplicitor sort of begins very early on, like 8 or 10 weeks, I think, right? So yeah, I think that's a fair point. The point about masturbation, sure. So there's probably the most famous philosophical argument against abortion is offered by a person named Don Marquis, who wants to focus on the wrongness of murder as being connected with the deprivation of a future. Right? And so he says, look, anytime you're depriving something of a future, right, then, of a future like ours, is the phrase he uses, then you're doing something seriously immoral. The problem is, it seems to run into this problem of the serious immorality of contraception. And so he wrestles with that one, too. And on the last point, Peter Singer, yeah, so Peter Singer is a particularly famous contemporary moral philosopher. He lines up quite closely with Thule, I think, on this line. He is a utilitarian in the vein of Jeremy Bentham, but he's quite close to Michael Thule in endorsing the claim that infanticide is, for example, not the killing of a person. He's an Australian philosopher. When he was hired at Princeton, there was quite a kind of kerfuffle about this. I think George Will was sort of famous. He wrote a long article when he wrote in the back page of Newsweek on, you know, why, you know, we ought to reject this and we ought not to want him to be teaching our youth. He's been successful in spite of that, or as successful as a philosopher gets. On the first point, I actually initially had a couple of slides in this talk on potentiality, because I agree that's an important point. I dropped it just because I didn't think I'd have enough time to talk about it. So you're right, the question of whether or not something is a potential person is a really interesting one. Now, I think the idea that you might think of moral status as a kind of continuum rather than either being a person or not as being a sort of a binary thing, I think is an important point. Kant's ethics is sort of famously troubled by this, and it runs all the way through those who have been influenced by Kant, including, for example, John Rawls, a political theorist, who has a tough time figuring out how to reckon with beings who aren't persons because they're not fully rational but are pretty close. This is sometimes seen as an advantage of utilitarianism because it opens up that view as a kind of spectrum rather than a kind of binary on-off thing, either you're this or you're not. Because I agree that point about something being close to a person is a complicated one. The evolutionary point. I guess I'm skeptical of putting, I'm not skeptical of evolution, I'm skeptical of putting too much weight, morally speaking, on evolutionary claims like that. While I'm sure it's true that there may be some sort of evolutionary imperative to behave in some way or not behave in some way, I think that's the tricky thing to figure out, right? And so that's why I get worried about those kinds of things. I often think that when we use terms like human in a moral sense, that what we're doing is really just employing a different category than the purely biological one. Right? It's sort of like going back to Spock, right? There's a bunch of examples in Star Trek where they're like, oh, that's the most human thing you've ever done, Spock. But I take it they often mean not biological, but something different than that. So anyway, fair enough. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Before I read the closing words, I just wanted to say that there were a lot of people who wanted to talk today and discuss this topic because it was so good, and thank you so much for doing such a good job. We'll have a future opportunity because a program to be scheduled will be about, just a little preview here, about the UU Animal Ministries working towards looking at our first principle and perhaps expanding it to include non-human animals in person, in the phrase person. So we're going to have a program about that, and perhaps it will be a collaboration, so that would be awesome. So the closing words, we saw them on the slide. Jeremy Bentham from 1789, a full-grown horse or dog is beyond comparison a more rational as well as a more conversable animal than an infant of a day or even a week or even a month old. But suppose the case were otherwise, what would it avail? The question is not can they reason, nor can they talk, but can they suffer? And we're ready to extinguish the chalice. And our closing words, we extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. And please stay for a few minutes to greet one another and maybe have some more refreshment. Thank you.